showed no interest was they were already working hot and heavy on it and did not want to risk compromising what they had by opening it up like that. Now, to get more to the technology, most of the frequency hopping radio is where there is a time base and there's a hopping program, and you have to have the hopping on both sides. And every so many milliseconds, both on transmit and receive, you have to switch frequency. And it's carefully covered with the switching codes and the method of accomplishing the time matching, especially since, you know, there's propagation delay for the signals, so you have to take that into account too. Another approach, more at the higher frequencies, is pseudo noise spreading, where you modulate the signal with a complicated digital pattern that widens the signal and makes it sound like noise. And only when you have the proper, again, coding and timing, and it's constantly changing, that things resolve themselves to provide intelligible signal.
Thank you, Ed. Yeah, there's a lot of clever encryption technology. You know, nowadays it's so ridiculously improved because everything is digitized and that it runs through different encryption algorithms. Modern police department is finally starting to encrypt their transmission data. The fire department also. Back in the old days, you encoded things primarily, they were kind of on an analog basis. There's only so many things that you could screw around with analog. Digital, there's no limit. People talk about quantum encryption. We'll see how that works out. But there's so many different encryption algorithms available in the digital domain.
Should I go to the next level there?
Please feel free.
Military aircraft use combat control. It's a variation of civilian air traffic control, IFF. But they have highly, highly encrypted stuff to prove that this hunk of metal out there is our hunk of metal and not their hunk of metal. And this gets really, really, really hairy. And the NSA themselves does the encryptions, and they're constantly generating codes that are changing constantly over the day, and then at midnight GMT, they roll over to a whole new set of codes.
Well, I don't know. I hope it makes everyone feel safe. Encryption technology, the NSA is kind of the king of that, and there are always somewhat paranoid people that think the NSA waters down commercial encryption technology so that, or builds a back door in it so that they can listen in on all of us no matter what we do under any circumstance. And then whenever anyone mentions quantum computing, they mention that it's theoretically possible for quantum computers to break the encryption algorithm that power the internet, the RSA and all the prime number based encryption technologies, and that hasn't been done yet. It's been done in theory with very, very, very small prime numbers, but not the massive ones that are used in a lot of the encryption technologies. But the NSA is hopefully on our side, so sleep easier.
I've been to a number of NATO meetings going into this. Great detail. These people are serious, deadly serious about this.
I would hope so. I mean, encryption generally should be a very serious topic. It powers military, it powers politics, it powers the entire financial mechanisms that keep a currency working the way it's supposed to. If all of a sudden all the encryption technologies fell apart, it would wreak havoc with this world in untold ways.
Let me put it this way, Roy. When you return from a successful combat mission and you're shut down by your own air defenses, that really, really sucks.
I could well imagine. It would ruin my day, if not my life.
It's called playing for keeps.
Yeah, well, I mean, usually war, unfortunately, requires you to do that. Friendly fire kills you just as much as unfriendly fire.
No, they don't call it friendly fire anymore. It's fratricide.
Really? Since when?
About 10 years ago.
Oh, okay. I didn't get the memo. That sort of reminds me of the bad days in Vietnam, where people reported stories that some people would just kind of throw a grenade in the tent of their commanding officer and stroll away.
Yeah, it's only spraying. And no, it was only unpopular officers. When you are a drafted runt and your patrol leader is trying to build up his reputation by getting you guys killed, it leads to desperate measures, desperate requests, requirements lead to desperate measures.
Yeah. War is serious. People die in wars. Certainly no one makes a fun of any of it. And fortunately for me, my only exposure has been in watching Catch-22 and MASH, which is about the closest I would like to get to armed warfare, personally.
Catch-22 is about World War II, and MASH is supposedly about the Korean War. Although the original movie, which I hated, was all kinds of snarky comments about Vietnam that I thought turned it into a travesty. But no, this is serious stuff, and it has to be addressed.
I agree with you entirely, by the way, AC2GS. Just to throw out a little weirdness, I grew to dislike the MASH television show. I kind of liked watching it when I was a little kid, but it went into reruns, and everyone was affected by it. And I still remember I had this biology course in college, and inevitably there was a dissection practical, and almost everyone in that room felt a need to mimic the smart-ass comments from MASH TV episodes.
I'm sorry to hear that. Although I have my own burden, I absolutely, flatly refuse to see those, those Tom Cruise flying movies, because I know how stuff is really done, and I can't take that crap.
Yeah, I can sort of understand. I mean, I've seen a lot of medical shows. I take them from where they came. I particularly enjoyed House. House is ridiculous as a nonfiction work. House is supposed to be a diagnostician. There is no field of medicine called diagnostic medicine. This is to just start off with. But I take it for what it's worth. It's a dramatic presentation. It's supposed to amuse people. So I kind of filter out the absurdity of it all.
Oh, it's totally unrelated, but yet related, sorry?
Sure.
I was recently being on an escorted tour of something, and the guide said, as a historian, I can't take those historical movies.
Oh, well, you've really kind of pushed a button with me. I have found lately and I don't want to get political, the non-historical diversity of historical productions just annoys the heck out of me. I understand what's going on underlying it all, and that as far as the people producing it, they don't give a damn about history, but it just annoys the heck out of me. Just the absurdity of the diverse cast of 15th century England. England was not very diverse in the 15th century. I'm sorry.
Let me tell you something. If you can see the enemy, you're lost.
Well, it depends on the era. If you see the enemy 2,000 years, if you didn't see the enemy 2,000 years ago, it probably wasn't a particular battle. Nowadays, you could never see the enemy, with drones and all these other damn things.
Modern airborne combat. Nowadays it's taking place at hundreds of miles away. You never come within sight of the enemy, and if you do, that's only because you've messed up big time.
Yeah, but again, the unfortunate reality is these are dramas. These are designed to entertain people, not to inform them, and certainly not to be particularly accurate. I enjoyed Mel Gibson's Braveheart. It was like a soap opera. It was absurd. Historically, people were the wrong age. The princess that he supposedly slept with was an infant living in France at the time he died. I take it as just a pageant.
Let me be clear about something. While I'm talking about modern military tactics, I did this sitting in conference rooms with a lot of people with very heavily encrusted uniforms.
Yeah, but again, drummers are not ultimately designed to be accurate. They're designed optimally to be popular and to be profitable, primarily profitable. So I will never kind of walk away from a movie or a television show and assume that this demonstrates any aspect of reality. It's just, is it entertaining? Is it not entertaining? Because there's a lot of things that if you do it true, lose any kind of dramatic impact. So it will lead to a very accurate retelling of something that bores people and that people wouldn't pay money to see. So it doesn't get done. So I understand you, and occasionally that flares up with me when people kind of play really fast and loose with reality. But, you know, I got to kind of rejigger my brain and kind of keep telling myself that this is all just a means to an end of making some money at the end of the week. I'm sorry, Ed, and whoever that is, we were tripling. The third person, not me, not Ed, do you want to give it a try again? I guess not. So, Ed, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I understand people like to be entertained, and dogfights are very entertaining. Dogfights don't really, I don't think, exist anymore. They probably never will, but it's something like cowboys and Indians that people keep going back to.
Yeah, and I was worried you were telling me that Barbie is real.
Well, maybe in an alternate reality someplace. You actually watched Barbie? It's on my list of many things that someday I'll waste my time seeing. I don't know. It didn't look appealing to me at the time.
Let me say this. Barbie is a flawed movie. But it throws some real silliness at you, and there is some seriousness behind it that has nothing to really do. It exists on two levels. There's the obvious silly story, and there is some seriousness under it, but in both cases, there are definitely flaws, but I saw it, I turned my brain off at the door, and I enjoyed it.
Okay, I understand entirely. You can't really take life serious 100% of the time. You gotta put it into, maybe not turn it off, but put it into standby mode.
Ah, belly dancing, you ready?
Okay.
Some friends of ours were the entertainment committee for some dinner for something, and they invited us, even though we weren't members of the group. And the entertainment was they brought in this young woman to demonstrate belly dancing. And she was sitting right next to me at dinner, and we were chatting. And then when her act comes on, because she knows me, she calls me up. And you know damn well this is going to be beyond embarrassing. But when you know from the get-go it can only be embarrassing, it will never be anything but embarrassing, it's not really embarrassing.
Yeah, that's the best approach to take. There are still people out there who would just kind of hide under the table, despite that.
I've seen that too, sir.
Yeah, I never really liked the pseudo Broadway shows where they kind of nag audiences into doing something during the show. I figured that you know, I paid my ticket, you know, they didn't pay any ticket for me to act like an idiot.
I'm a little more flexible with that, but even I have my limits.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends upon what mood you're in and then how much alcohol you've imbibed.
Ever imbibed alcohol before a Broadway performance.
Okay, I never recorded. Probably I didn't either because they were too early, and if I had drinks, I tended to have them later in the evening. So my guess would be the same. You know, thankfully, none of us out there are you know, the type that get up in the morning and put something in their orange juice.
You're picking on orange juice.
Well, it's the easiest thing to mix with some kind of alcohol. It could be coffee, but more people drink orange juice, I think, than coffee. Well, that seems to have faded down. Let me just try one last time. There was some person in the background. I could just barely make them out. They were tripling with me and Ed. So if you're out there and you want to give it one more try, please do. Oh, well, perhaps some other time. Well, thank you, Ed. John, are you out there? KC2SHO. John, I see on the windows that you're connected to the All-Star, so are you out there? Okay, I guess John stepped away. He's done that before from the All-Star. Busy family life out there, so probably he's celebrating Mother's Day as well. So maybe he'll come back a little later. We'll try him again. Let's try something a little different. For the last month or so, I've been trying to remember to summon up a poll, our own WS2N, to talk about the three-body problem. It's a very weird, interesting trilogy, three books originally written by a Chinese author in China, translated to English. It's been made into a TV series in China. It's been made into a TV series in Netflix. And I was just curious about people's reaction to it. So Paul, how did you find three-body problem? I understand you enjoyed it.
WS2N, very good, very well done. They covered a lot of possible physics problems that you could imagine, you know. There was one right after the other. And it started off weird, you know. This isn't going to go anywhere, but after the first 15, 20 minutes, it turned out to be a very good movie. Following this one, pretty much this one woman from when she was young all the way through through the years, and she was an expert in physics just like her father was, you have to see it. It's an epic. I would say it's an epic film. Looks like they spent a lot of money on special effects, that's for sure. Yeah, very, very good. If anybody, I don't want to talk too much about it, because if anybody wants to see it, it's worth watching. The three-body problem, you know, the idea that there's a star out there, three stars, and how's that going to affect a planet? You know, is it going to stay hot all the time? Is it going to turn cold? Is it going to stay the way it is? And nobody could figure this out. It deals with alien technology. You know, it was their problem, and now they got to come to Earth. Back to you, Russ.
AC2GS. Yeah, it's sort of fascinating, and they take a lot of liberty with physics. They discuss 11-dimensional. Universes, their enemy is from Centauri. The three stars, supposedly there's a planet that somehow is able to survive three stars kind of circling each other violently. So it's a fascinating thing. It's just that, you know, when I saw part of it, I noticed that they decided to kind of go back and forth in time, and I wondered if people were going to completely lose touch with what's going on. That first scene that you saw, the first scene in the book itself, was kind of a speed bump to me, because I had gotten the book thinking it was going to be a science fiction book about aliens and things, and all of a sudden I'm in the Great Revolution, and a bunch of Chinese peasants are beating up Chinese professors. And I say to myself, what? And I was worried that it was going to be a very Chinese-centric science fiction novel that I wouldn't be able to wrap my head around. But thankfully, when you got past that, that was kind of the author's way of starting the story up. It got increasingly better, if not somewhat increasingly bizarre.
I agree. And normally I watch all TV with closed captions, but they had a lot of parts where people were speaking in Chinese, Mandarin, and they have the translation come across, and they go back and forth to one, and sometimes on the quick side. So what's good, if you have a good remote, I just click it at many different parts, and then a closed caption stays there. And I can read the translation Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to follow, you know, from one part to the next. There isn't a lot of that, but it's enough where you really need that translation back to Europe.
Yeah, that's what they want, decided to handle it. You know, different people have different problems with when there's other languages. Some people don't want to read a TV show or a movie. At least this Netflix version is a lot less Chinese than the original book. In the original book, I think at least 50 to 60% of the characters are Chinese, and certainly the first half of a book is mostly in China. So they kind of did away with that. And there are people in South America, there are people in America, there are people in Europe. It's all over the place. And, you know, when they are in China, they do Chinese and they do subtitles. Not too much. You know, I've seen others that are a little bit more annoying. You know, I mean, even Dune kind of does that, where sometimes they're talking in the language of Arrakis, and you see the translation at the very bottom, and you have to read your movie. But, you know, it's one way of dealing with it. If everyone was always talking English, it might be a little bit more boring. Who knows?
Okay, yeah. And the three-body problem, you know, I saw that. I said, you know, I'll have to watch. By the way, this is Netflix, the one we're talking about. PBS had another version of it, and all Chinese, and it's just, you know, different actors, different everything. And I would not be able to get through that. But Netflix did a very good job at this. I think of the three-body problem, like some of our spacecraft that are out in the L2 position, Launch Point 2. You know, you have James Webb Space Telescope out there. You've had the Planck Telescope is out there. Or the European Space Agency, Gaia, is still out there. There's another one going to be on its way soon. And that sits 1 million miles away from Earth, traveling around the sun. So, you know, you have the sun at the center. The sun has one end, Earth is the center. And then a million miles out is the satellite. And the three-body problem there is those three items, and how do you keep them completely aligned, you know, so this way you don't use any fuel. And you really can't. So you do need fuel on board, because you have to use a little here and there. It keeps it close, but not 100%. Every once in a while, it'll drift off to a spot that you don't want. So you have to, you know, hit a couple of thrusters to get back where you're supposed to be. But it's very minimal. But, you know, that's the three-body problem. You just can't leave it there without adjusting it. And they covered that in the movie, what the problem is with that alien planet. You know, the aliens could never really figure out over centuries and eons of time where the planet was going to be. You know, and they had to keep restarting their civilizations over and over again. Every time something went seriously wrong because they got too close or too far away from one of the stars. Back to you, Roy. WS2I.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, what you're kind of talking about is these quasi-stable points. Three-body problems usually are not solvable. They're chaotic systems. If one of the three bodies is much, much less massive, then you can do a rough approximation. You can do quasi-stable positions and such. But in the case of the book, they were talking about three stars. So lots of luck. You know, none of them are that much less massive than the others. So it was a completely chaotic system. Anyway, Netflix will be putting out at least a couple more series of this book. You know, they just kind of touched the very beginning. It goes almost to the end of time, so there's a lot more material out there. Anyone else out there take in the three-body problem? I'm interested in opinions. And if not, if you have Netflix or a friend who has Netflix, take a look at it. And don't get annoyed by the first half hour of the episode. You try and watch the whole first episode before you decide. Okay. I guess no one else is interested in three-body problems tonight. Let's see if John is back from wherever he was. John, KC2SHO, are you out there? I guess he stepped away. Anyway, any other questions or comments for the night? We got a little free time here, so if anyone has any interesting things to say, hit that push to talk.
AS2PS.
Hello. What can I do you for today?
A couple of weeks back, I asked about a HD radio. I have more data on the problem. If it's of interest, I'll give it to you.
Sure.
Okay, just as a reminder, this is an HD radio with all the bells and whistles in the car, parked outside my house in Harrison, New York. The HD channel, if you call it that, comes and goes. It pops in and out. It's in most of the time. It drops out for a second or two and comes back in. So I drove around. I went to Yonkers Raceway to give everybody an idea. You can look it up on a map. Yonkers Raceway is high, and I was in a field that was 1,000 feet from anything. And in that field, I timed it, and it would be 3 minutes and 7 minutes. And the radio would drop out after 3 minutes, come back, and then 7 minutes later drop out, come back, 3 minutes later drop out, 7 minutes drop out. Yonkers Radio is shown to be, let me drop. Yonkers Raceway is shown to be within the area that HD should be solid. So that's what I discovered. It drops out much more frequently in Harrison, which is farther away from the transmitter. And what I noticed was if I go to Portchester, when it drops out, which is even farther away, the little signal loss decal comes up on the radio. So that's the data I have. The next step is to replace the radio.
Yeah, did you have a chance to contact the retailer you bought it from? Tell them any of this?
Yes, I did. I went over there, and they're going to replace the radio. But they indicated, they live in Somers, New York. And up there you can't get reception on HD worth a damn. They indicated they thought that was kind of the way it worked, but that's how it works in Somers. So their experience doesn't include knowing about that. But they're going to replace the radio just to see if that fixes it. It's all under warranty.
Oh, okay. That's good to hear that they keep to their warranty. Well, let us know how the switch out worked for you. My assumption, the way that you're relating the story, is that there's something off with the circuitry in that radio, and hopefully when they swap it for another one, you'll get much more consistent reception.
Yeah, we'll see. The only other thought I had, which is, I'm really stretching. Well, I'm parked at Yonkers Raceway, and this is going on, and it's much higher elevation. I'm thinking 7 minutes and then 3 minutes, and that's not exact, of course, but it's very close. I'm wondering if it has something to do with a flight path, something flying over Manhattan between the antenna and Yonkers. But anyway, we'll find out, and once I get this thing replaced, and I don't know when that'll be, I'll get back on and let the people know. But thank you. I wanted to update in case anybody's interested. AF2P, I'll go back to listening to the fascinating subject.
Okay, very good. Thanks for telling us how things are going. I wish you luck, and I look forward to your next message being good news for you.
Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Limemark Technical Net, and we're still open for business. We have a little bit more time left, so if anyone has any topic for discussion, questions, comments, what have you, please hit that push to talk.
Roy, this is Charlie.
Yes, Charlie.
Last week I had asked you how big of a solar panel I'm going to need to run my 50-watt radio. My question is, if I use a solar panel that's 1,000 watts to run a 50-watt radio, would that destroy my radio?
No, because that's a maximum amount of current that you would be producing, but not going into your load. Your load is determined by the resistance in your radio. So, you know, you could hook up, you know, it's kind of the same thing with utility lines. Just because you plug in a nightlight to your utility lines that you could run an air conditioner doesn't mean that your nightlight will blow up. So the answer is no. If you have an overpowered solar battery, it will just take the amount of current that the device wants. It shouldn't overpower it as long as you get the voltages right. You know, if you start to feed it more than, you know, 12.8, 13 volts, then you're going to have problems. But if it's outputting 13 volts, it should only draw the amount of current that it's designed to draw.
WB2E80.
Ed.
A couple of years ago, I did some research and a proposal on a solar/battery deal for some stuff. I have found that the largest individual solar panels are somewhere around 300 watts, maybe creeping up on 400. Anything above that, you have to use multiple panels. And it's only the smaller ones that put out about 12 volts. The ones I'm talking about will put out about 25, even 40 volts. And remember, the voltages will vary tremendously with whether it's getting direct sunlight or at an angle. So this is not a trivial concern. And if you just blindly blunder ahead, you could burn out a radio.
Okay, well, as I said before, he has to make sure that the output voltage of his solar battery, as it is, I still don't like the idea of directly feeding a solar battery to a power device. It's much nicer and cleaner if you use the solar energy to recharge your rechargeable battery and then use the power from a steady state battery to operate your loads.
Yes, having a battery in there does give you a lot of regulation and isolation.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very troublesome, you know, the next time a cloud came past, your voltage would drop, your power would drop. Some radios can stand low voltage situations, some act very weird. So again, that's really not the best method, just hooking up a solar battery, a solar cell to a load, you know, unless it's something like a light bulb or some such. But any finicky little electronics, you're best to have some kind of power controlling intermediary between the solar cell and the load.
Thank you. I'll use the battery. I'll listen to you.
Okay. It should work out fine. You know, you have your choice if you want to use lead acid or if you want to use lithium iron phosphate. I'm a big fan of lithium iron phosphate. A couple of weeks ago, someone at another TechNet was having problems. They had bought lithium iron phosphate, and apparently the cells had burnt out. You could only get something like 1.3 volts. The lithium iron phosphates are multi-celled rechargeable batteries with load balancing and safety circuits, and they have been known to build little iron filings shorting out different cells. So they're not super batteries, but they're very good. They have very good specifications if they're a little bit more expensive than lead acid. But both are useful to be used along with solar cells.
A2STP with a question?
Sure.
Good evening, Roy. K2STP Mobile. Quick question about the solar panels. I've always wondered this. If they're not attached to anything, where is the power going or what happens? Is the photoelectric being created, not being created? Or what actually happens to a solar panel when it's got no load on it?
Well, I mean, what happens to a battery that doesn't have a load on it? It's, you know, solar cells are interesting devices because really if you think about them, they're kind of the symmetry of light-emitting diodes. Light-emitting diodes are similar to semiconductor material. You put a voltage potential between the two parts, and it emits light. Solar cells, you shine light at it, and it produces a voltage potential between the two terminals. So if there's nothing acting as a load to those two terminals, it comes and it goes. Nothing is drawing it out, so it just dissipates when the light goes out at night.
So basically it's not creating the power because... Oh, interesting. I never really thought about this. Anyway, thank you. K2SD, please, mobile.
Yeah, it's creating a voltage potential difference. What you do with that voltage potential difference is up to you. If you draw it out and store it someplace, great. Otherwise, it will dissipate as waste heat in the semiconductor material of the solar cell.
So I would guess a solar panel would be hot or warmer, I should say, if it's not connected to a load, then if it was connected to a load, it would be cooler. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I sort of would say it would be less hot because it would be drawing off some of the energy that wouldn't be changed into just waste heat. Without any kind of load, anything that it absorbs, it's going to readmit. If you have something that absorbs it, it draws off some of the energy which would have gone into thermal waste heat, so it would be less hot. It'll still be hot because it's exposed to the sun, and it's not 100% efficient in changing light to electrical potential, energy and current and such, but it would be less hot than if you had something connected drawing off the current.
Gotcha. Understood. Makes sense. And yes, what are we at, 21% or something efficiency? So I guess normally 80% is going to heat somehow or somewhere. Okay, thank you. K2S at TP Mobile.
You're welcome. Yeah. 80% is just going to heat. You know, I mean, that's a way of most energy losses and transfers. Tend to be dissipated as heat, and the same thing goes with solar cells. And hopefully, as time goes on, they'll make them a little bit more efficient. You know, back I think 20 years ago, if you had 8 or 10%, that was a good number. But they've improved over time.
What's an efficient output for a solar cell?
Like we mentioned, approximately 20% of the energy that it's the sunlight is baking on it.
So there's that 80% loss with solar cells?
Yes. These conversions from one energy to another tend to be relatively inefficient. Photosynthesis is incredibly less efficient than solar cells. The amount of energy extracted by chlorophyll is only a couple of percent.
Wow.
Yeah, well, but it's enough to feed all the non-vegetative life forms on this planet. So, you know, sometimes 2 to 3% of a lot is still a lot.
I figured they had a 20% loss and an 80%, you know, I'm grabbing this 80% and I'm going to make it all electric.
Well, that would be very, very nice, and if you could figure out a way of doing it, I'm sure you'd get at least one Nobel Prize and probably a lot of profit. But no, at this point, you know, unless you're using very esoteric materials in which the cost of the solar cell would be prohibitive, you're not going to get much farther than about 20% efficiencies.
Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And people are working on it every single day. I used to do endless stories about graphene, and one of the many things that people were hoping to be able to do with graphene was to improve the efficiency of solar cells, because that would make an enormous difference in things. So, but they're still working on it. Large-scale production of graphene is not anywhere close to being done. We can kind of produce very small flecks of the material, enough to do very interesting experiments that whet our interest for doing it on an industrial scale. But the means to produce large-scale graphene is nowhere near in sight. Anyway, we still got a few more minutes here, so if anyone has any topics for discussion, comments to be made, questions to be asked, please feel free, hit that push to talk.
K2-1-2-John.
Yes, John?
My question is about the word bandwidth. We all use bandwidth in ham radio, you know it's the number. In computers, bandwidth is a condition different.
Well, I don't think it's accurate to say that bandwidth in amateur radio is different than bandwidth in computers. The problem is that we use bandwidth in two different ways for amateur radio. The symbol rate of our transmissions are based upon the bandwidth, the range of frequencies in a transmission. For something like CW, it's not uncommon to have a bandwidth of about 100 hertz. There's only so much data you can squeeze into a narrow bandwidth like that. If you start to go faster on your Morse code, you'll find that the skirts of your frequency widen, so the bandwidth of your high-speed CW signal get larger because it's required to hold that amount of information. So in the same way that computers use bandwidth as the signal rate, you can also use bandwidth in terms of amateur radio to determine symbol rates. So in one way, amateur radio bandwidth is equivalent to computer concepts of bandwidth. You're welcome. Sometimes when it comes to physics, they run out of terms and they reuse them to the point where it leads to people to a lot of different confusion. Every so often when we actually talk about quantum mechanics and quantum spin is mentioned, I try and stop people from thinking that quantum spin is the same as mechanical angular motion spin, because electrons do not rotate in space like planets do. The rotation, the spin is a quantum concept and happens in the nature of a quantum equation, and it's not a little electron just kind of spinning like a top. But in the case of bandwidth, thankfully, there isn't that much ambiguity. Anyway, anyone with any other comments or questions tonight before we move to our next segment?
This is a K2 Deepa.
Yes?
I'm kind of new to the radio. I'm just wondering what a session this is tonight.
This is the Limark Technical Net. It's been going on for about 44 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. we get together on W2VL at 146.85, and we talk about technology. For most of that, it was done, the net control operator was Dick K2RIW a few years ago. Unfortunately, Dick passed away and became a silent key, and I've been running it since then.
Questions is, I noticed the guys on this frequency is voiced on like 5 other channels. I'm just wondering what's the main frequency for this.
Okay, not quite sure what you mean by 5 other channels. What's going on with us, Limark is Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, is it has a lot of repeaters. It has one repeater that's linked with W2VL, so that's the Plainview repeater. So you'll hear the same signal coming from Plainview as you will from Glen Oaks, which I'm operating through right now. Limark does have other repeaters, but I do not believe that they are linked at this time. There are other devices that are linked to this transmission. We have an EchoLink, so if you have EchoLink and you went to the node W2VL, you'd be able to interact. We have an IRLP link, so other repeaters that link to us. There's one in Barrie, Ontario, Canada, that has linked to us during the technical net, and we also have an All-Star link. So as far as repeaters, it's just it's just two repeaters that are linked together. There shouldn't be 5.
Quick correction and Y2H.
Oh, okay. Are there 5, Lou?
Okay, so W2VL Glen Oaks is linked to 2 other repeaters, none of which are in Plainview. One is in Selden and one is in Middle Island. And this particular person you're talking with is coming in from the Selden repeater right now.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I always get Plainview and Selden mixed up, so there's 3. I didn't know Middle Island is linked to us these days.
Yeah, it's been that way for quite a while now.
Okay, so we have 3 linked repeaters. The rest of the links are IRLP, EchoLink, and All-Star.
Okay, I understand that.
Okay. Like I said, we're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m., so if you ever have any questions or want to listen to a technical net, we're here. Anyway, coming toward the end of this particular segment, but if anyone has any other comments, questions, statements, what have you, please hit that push to talk.
So the guy that noticed that I was coming through the cell and a repeater, is he working at the cell and repeater? It's kind of confusing how he figured it out. But this is a KE2DFS.
I'm not quite sure what the question is. You're getting into the linked repeaters through Selden, and I'm getting in through Glen Oaks, and there's Middle Island as well, and they're all linked together, I think, through the Internet.
Okay, so you can notice it through apps and stuff like that.
Well, you know, Lou is part of the technical committee. He keeps an eye on us all and makes sure the repeater is working well, and he kind of is able to tell which signal is coming from what repeater. Oh, well. Well, let me just try one last time with John. John, KC2SHO, are you out there? Okay, I guess not. Anyway, thanks for everyone who participated tonight. I appreciate all of your participation, and I hope you'll come back next week when we try and do this all over again. But it's coming close to 10:13:55 seconds. So we might as well move on to Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report.
Thanks, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet Report. And, the first thing I was going to talk about, of course, was the coronal mass ejection that we had. But we covered that in the early part of the net. You know, the skies were supposed to be very easy to see different colors up there, green and pink and all. But unfortunately, we had clouds 2 nights ago. And then last night, a little bit less clouds, but still, you know, not able to, I was not able to see anything. If you pointed your cell phone to the sky, they said the cell phones were able to pick up different colors, which I had these phones. I tried it on my phone, it didn't work. And an Android, maybe I needed an iPhone or something for that. You know, you needed to leave it on long exposure, and apparently it worked. Even if you didn't see the colors in the sky, the phone picked it up. But, we'll have to wait another, who knows how many years before that happens again. Back in the 80s, we had a big event like that. Of course, power outages, I think, throughout Canada, and all kinds of problems. I haven't heard any real problems that were, you know, a result of this solar storm, so maybe that we figured out a way to protect ourselves a little bit better than in the 80s, and I think that in the 90s there was another one like that. Let me drop it. So, like satellites are somewhat susceptible to it, and they have temporary, like shutdown type of mode. They do a couple of things. They'll shut some systems down. They'll also rotate the satellite where, let's say, some heavy part of the satellite, like the batteries or something, is facing the sun to try to protect some of the electronics. These satellites, and some of them have done that. I read a preliminary report that SpaceX was affected to some degree, but I can't confirm that yet. He's got 6,000 satellites up there now. I heard Charlie say that earlier, and that's true. And by the way, he has a goal of 30,000 satellites. You know, once he gets his Starship going, he plans on, you know, loading up satellites into that thing and shooting them out. So like a Pez dispenser, you know. And one right after the other. Satellite after satellite, Starship after Starship. That does not sound like a good idea, because he's not the only one that wants to do it. China wants to put
30,000 satellites up there as well. You got a Kuiper system by Blue Origin. Their goal is 600 satellites. You have OneWeb up there now, and I think they're over 600 to 700 satellites already active. And that's just a broadband. There's, of course, geosynchronous satellites. Who knows how many they have at 23,000 miles above the surface. Then halfway between in the 11,000-mile area above the surface, you have GPS satellites. We have them. Europe has them. They launch a constellation called Galileo. Of course, China has them. And it's no wonder we can see the moon with all these things flying around. I have a pretty good app on my phone, which, you know, you point it at the sky and you can tell, you know, what planet you're looking at or what star you're looking at. But if you zoom in, by the way, the app is Stellarium. If you zoom in on Stellarium, you can see little movements going by, little teeny stars that are moving. Let's say zooming in on a planet or a star, and then you know you realize these things are actually satellites. You zoom in even more, and they act graphic descriptions of these satellites, and they'll actually tell you which one they are. You know, it might be, you know, a Galileo satellite, or it might be a geosynchronous satellite. It might be a Russian Cosmos satellite. It'll tell you Cosmos number, you know, 328 or something. But most of them that you see floating by.
Paul?
Okay, stand by, Charlie. Most of them that you see floating by on this app are Starlink satellites. Elon Musk's broadband system. And you zoom in anywhere in the sky, and all of a sudden you'll see another little thing go floating by, and zoom in, and it'll say Starlink, you know, number 2,325. Anyway, Charlie, back to you, WS2M.
Now, we have now 6,000. China is putting up satellites. How many is Russia putting up?
They don't have a broadband system going up right now that I know of. They're piggybacking off of Starlink, from what I heard. Yeah, you know, for the war in Ukraine, and Musk is trying to, you know, correct all that. That's a political problem. But they have a lot of military satellites, communication satellites for themselves. But they, you know, they're all called Cosmos, COMOS, and with a number after it. And they've been launching satellites, you know, for the last, you know, 60, 70 years. But the numbers that they have are not very high, you know. It's probably in the hundreds. They probably launched thousands over the years, but they burn out after a while, Charlie. So, yeah. My guess is I wouldn't be surprised if there's maybe 100 or so active Russian satellites. We're not worried about them. China, of course, they want to eventually put up these thousands of satellites as well for their own communication system. And back to you, Charlie.
Is this satellite putting out 5G?
That's not popular yet. Right now, I can think of four satellites that have that capability, and two of them are from the Kuiper system with Jeff Bezos, Blue Origin. The Kuiper system, that's the one that's going to eventually have like 3,500 satellites. Right now, I think they have two, and they ran a test with it with a cell phone from some island somewhere to see if they could talk to Italy, and it turned out that was very successful. But that's just a couple of test satellites that they have up there. They haven't really started to load up yet. They're waiting for the New Glenn rocket and systems to be developed. Another rocket, maybe equivalent to almost as big as the Saturn V rocket, heavy duty. And once that starts flying, they'll be able to put a whole bunch of satellites up. But they've also contracted with the European Space Agency to launch their satellites, the Kuiper satellites, on the brand new Ariane 6 rocket that hasn't flown, probably will fly, I think, late July will be the first one. They also contracted with the United Launch Alliance to launch on the Vulcan rocket, the new Vulcan rocket, which they've only launched one so far, but it was very successful. And there'll be many more to come in the future. They've got, I think it's, $8 or $10 billion worth of satellites that are scheduled to go up from basically three rockets, their own rocket, the New Glenn, the Vulcan rocket, like I mentioned before, and the Ariane 6, European Space Agency, these are all heavy lift rockets, by the way. Back to you, Charles.
So these satellites, these are still 4G satellites?
Well, these are broadband satellites. They're able to you can transmit data up, from your computer and down. But the only four that I can think of is the two from that were just launched by Blue Origin as a test for the Kuiper system. Again, mainly broadband, but they do have the capability of doing cell phones. And the other two are from SpaceX, which they just launched, I think, in that last batch that you were talking about, Charlie. They launched, I think, 24 satellites. And I think two of them have that capability. They're testing out that capability as well to see if you can have communications just using a cell phone. I don't know how practical that's going to be, though. Suppose I'm in the basement. Is my signal really going to get through my house? Through my walls of the house, all the way up I think they're around 300 miles above the surface. I wonder about that, Charlie.
And everything went well.
Yeah, okay. And right now they're over, that company is over 300 launches. And they plan on doing, I think, 140 from SpaceX, which is incredible. And I think in a couple of weeks, I just read this recently, that they plan on trying another Starship launch from Boca Chica, Texas, within about 3 or 4 weeks. They've launched three of those things so far. This will be the fourth. And not one has really, of course, made it to orbit. They weren't designed to go to orbit. These are test vehicles. In fact, they design it where, if they go up and there's something wrong, automatically it will come back through the atmosphere and burn up. The last thing they want is this 180 feet long Starship satellite flying around in endless orbit. They don't want that. So they're designed to go up and come down, and once they feel they're comfortable with the design of that space rocket, Starship, then at that point they'll start putting these things into orbit.
Paul, do they have a manned space lift for tomorrow?
No, there's no people going up until Friday, and that will not be SpaceX. I was going to talk about that as well. That's the what they call the Starliner mission. That's the one by Boeing built the Starliner, and I've talked about that for the last couple of weeks, and that has Sonny Wilmore on board. She's an amateur radio operator. And then Butch Wilmore, also on board. That is going to be Friday at 1, a little after 1 p.m. is the scheduled time. I think I wrote it down somewhere. 1:16 p.m. So that should be good, at least it's a daytime launch.